rust and silver hairs of his sprouting beard. Likewise, on the darkly suffused flesh of his genitals in their morning state, standing stiff against his belly, and gone the deep, soft colour one would find in the heart of a shadowed rose.
"As to putting things right," he said, "I canna say, though I mean to try."
His eyes moved over me, stark naked, slightly salt-encrusted, and noticeably grimy about the feet and ankles. He smiled.
"Shall we make a start, Sassenach?"
"You're so tired you can barely stand up," I protested. "With certain exceptions," I added, glancing down. It was true. There were dark hollows under his eyes, and while the lines of his body were still long and graceful, they were also eloquent of deep fatigue.
I felt as though I'd been run over by a steamroller myself, and I hadn't been up all night burning down forts. "Well, seeing as we've a bed to hand, I didn't plan to stand up for it," he replied. "Mind, I may never get back on my feet again, but I think I might be able to stay awake for the next 10 minutes or so at least. You can pinch me if I fall asleep," he suggested, smiling.
I rolled my eyes at him, but didn't argue. I lay down upon the grubby but now cool sheets, and with a small tremor in the pit of my stomach, opened my legs for him. We made love like people underwater, heavy-limbed and slow, mute, able to speak only through crude pantomime. We had barely touched one another in this way since Mulva's death, and the thought of her was still with us. And not only her. For a time I tried to focus only on Jamie, fixing my attention on the small intimacies of his body so well known. The tiny white cicatrice of the triangular scar at his throat, the walls of auburn hair, and the sunburned skin beneath. But I was so tired that my mind refused to cooperate, and persisted in showing me instead random bits of memory, or, even more disturbing, imagination. "It's no good," I said. My eyes were tight shut, and I was clinging to the bedclothes with both hands, sheets knotted in my fingers. "I can't." He made a small sound of surprise, but at once rolled away, leaving me damp and trembling.
"What is it, Anian?"
he said softly. He didn't touch me, but lay close. "I don't know," I said, close to panic. "I keep seeing..." "I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Jamie. I see other people. It's like I'm making love to other men.
"Why?"
He sounded cautious, but not upset. There was a whish of fabric, and he drew the sheet up over me.
That helped a little, but not much. My heart was pounding hard in my chest.
I felt dizzy and couldn't seem to take a full breath. My throat kept closing.
"Bolus hystericus," I thought, quite calmly. "Do stop, Beecham."
Easier said than done, but I did stop worrying that I was having a heart attack.
"Ah,"
Jamie's voice was cautious.
"Who? Hodgepile and..."
"No!"
My stomach clenched in revulsion at the thought. I swallowed.
"No! I hadn't even thought of that." He lay quietly beside me, breathing. I felt as though I were literally coming apart.
"Who is it that you see, Claire?" he whispered.
"Can you tell me?"
"Frank,"
I said fast, before I could change my mind. "And Tom, and Mulva." My chest heaved, and I felt that I would never have enough air to breathe again. All of a sudden, I could feel them all," I blurted, "touching me, wanting to come in." I rolled over, burying my face in the pillow as though I could seal out everything. Jamie was silent for a long time. Had I hurt him? I was sorry that I told him, but I had no defenses any more. I couldn't lie, even for the best of reasons. There was simply no place to go, nowhere to hide. I felt beset by whispering ghosts, their loss, their need, their desperate love pulling me apart. Apart from Jamie. apart from myself.
My entire body was clenched and rigid, trying to keep from dissolution, and my face was pushed so deep into the pillow trying to escape that I felt I might suffocate and was obliged to turn my head, gasping for breath.
Claire. Jamie's voice was soft, but I felt his breath on my face and my eyes popped open. His eyes were soft, too, shadowed with sorrow. Very slowly he lifted a hand and touched my lips.
Tom, I blurted, I feel as though he's already dead because of me. And it's so terrible. I can't bear it, Jamie, I really can't.
I know.
He moved his hand, hesitated.
Can you bear it if I touch you?
I don't know. I swallowed the lump in my throat.
Try it and see.
That made him smile, though I'd spoken with complete seriousness. He put his hand gently on my shoulder and turned me, then gathered me against him, moving slowly so that I might pull back. I didn't. I sank into him and clung to him as though he was a floating spar, the only thing keeping me from drowning. He was. He held me close and stroked my hair for a long time.
"Can you weep for them, Muneen Doan?"
he whispered into my hair at last.
"Let them come in."
The mere idea made me go rigid with panic again. "I can't."
"Weep for them," he whispered,
and his voice opened me deeper than his cock.
"You cannot hold a ghost at bay."
"I can't. I'm afraid," I said. But I was already shaking with grief, tears wet on my face. "I can't." And yet I did. Gave up the struggle and opened myself to memory and sorrow. Sobbed as though my heart would break, and let it break, for them, and all I couldn't save.
"Let them come, and grieve them, Claire," he whispered. "And when they've gone, I'll take you home."
Chapter 99 Old Master River Run. It had rained hard the night before, and while the sun had come out bright and hot, the ground was soggy and steam seemed to rise from it, adding to the thickness of the air. Brianna had put her hair up to keep it off her neck, but wisps escaped constantly, clinging damply to forehead and cheeks, always in her eyes. She wiped a strand crossly with the back of her hand. Her fingers were smeared with the pigment she was grinding, and the humidity wasn't doing that any good, making the powder clump and cling to the sides of the mortar. She needed it, though. She had a new commission, due to start this afternoon. Jem was hanging around, too, bored and poking his fingers into everything. He was singing to himself, half under his breath. She paid no attention until she happened to catch a few words.
"What did you say?"
she asked, rounding on him incredulously. He couldn't have been singing Folsom Prison Blues, could he? He blinked at her, lowered his chin to his chest, and said, in the deepest voice he could produce,
"Hello, I'm Johnny Cash."
She narrowly stopped herself laughing out loud, feeling her cheeks go pink with the effort of containment. "Where did you get that?" she asked, though she knew perfectly well. There was only one place he could have gotten it, and her heart rose up at the thought.
"Daddy," he said logically. "Has Daddy been singing?" she asked, trying to sound casual. He had to have been.
And just as obviously, had to have been trying Claire's advice to shift the register of his voice so as to loosen his frozen vocal cords.
"Uh-huh. Daddy sings a lot. He teached me a song about Sunday morning and the one about Tom Dooley and lots,"
he ended, rather at a loss.
"Did he? Well, that's..."
"Put that down," she said, as he idly picked up an open pouch of rose madder.
Oops.
He looked guiltily at the blob of paint that had erupted from the leather pouch and landed on his shirt, then at her, and made a tentative move toward the door.
Oops, he says, she said darkly. Don't you move.
Snaking out a hand, she grabbed him by the collar and applied a turpentine-soaked rag vigorously to the front of his shirt, succeeding only in producing a large pink blotch rather than a vivid red line. Jem was silent during this ordeal, head bobbing as she pulled him to and fro, swabbing.
"What are you doing in here anyway?" she demanded crossly. "Didn't I tell you to go find something to do?"
There was no shortage of things to do at River Run, after all. He hung his head and muttered something in which she made out the word, scared.
Scared? Of what?
A little more gently, she pulled the shirt off over his head.
The ghost? What ghost?
She asked warily, not sure yet how to handle this. She was aware that all of the slaves at River Run believed implicitly in ghosts, simply as a fact of life. So did virtually all of the Scottish settlers in Cross Creek, Campbellton and the Ridge, and the Germans from Salem and Bethania. So, for that matter, did her own father. She couldn't simply inform Jem that there was no such thing as a ghost, particularly as she was not entirely convinced of that herself.
"Maister Arsi's ghost?"
he said, looking up at her for the first time, his dark blue eyes troubled.
"Josh says he's been walking."
Something skittered down her back like a centipede.
"Maister Arsi was old master, Hector Cameron."
Involuntarily she glanced toward the window. They were in the small room above the stable block, where she did the messier bits of paint preparation, and Hector Cameron's white marble mausoleum was clearly visible from here, gleaming like a tooth at the side of the lawn below.
"What makes Josh say that, I wonder?" she said, stalling for time.
Her first impulse was to observe that ghosts didn't walk in broad daylight, but the obvious corollary to that was that they did walk by night, and the last thing she wanted to do was give Jem nightmares.
"He says Angelina saw him night before last. A big old ghost," he said, stretching up, hands clawed, and widening his eyes in obvious imitation of Josh's account.
"Yeah, what was he doing?" She kept her tone light, only mildly interested, and it seemed to be working. Jem was more interested than scared, for the moment.
"Walking,"
Jem said, with a small shrug. What else did ghosts do, after all?
"Was he smoking a pipe?"
She'd caught sight of a tall gentleman strolling under the trees on the lawn below, and had an idea. Jem looked somewhat taken aback at the notion of a pipe-smoking ghost.
"I dunno," he said dubiously. "Do ghosts smoke pipes?"
"I sort of doubt it," she said. "But Mr. Buchanan does.
See him down there on the lawn?"
She moved aside, gesturing toward the window with her chin, and Jem rose up on his toes to look out over the sill. Mr. Buchanan, an acquaintance of Duncan's, who was staying at the house, was, in fact, smoking a pipe at this very moment. The faint aroma of his tobacco reached them through the open window.
"I think probably Angelina saw Mr. Buchanan walking around in the dark," she said. "Maybe he was in his nightshirt going out to the necessary, and she just saw the white and thought he was a ghost."
Jem giggled at the thought. He seemed willing to be reassured, but hunched his skinny shoulders, peering closely at Mr. Buchanan.
"Josh says Angelina says the ghost was coming out of old Mr. Hector's tomb," he said. "I expect Mr. Buchanan just walked round it, and she saw him coming along the side and thought he was coming out of it," she said, carefully avoiding any questions as to why a middle-aged Scottish gentleman should be walking round tombs in his nightshirt. Obviously, that wasn't a notion that struck Jemmy as odd. It did occur to her to ask just what Angelina was doing outside in the middle of the night seeing ghosts, but on second thought, better not.
The most likely reason for a maid's stealing out at night wasn't something a boy of Jemmy's age needed to hear about either. Her lips tightened a little at the thought of Malva Christie, who had perhaps gone to a rendezvous of her own in Claire's garden. Who? She wondered for the thousandth time, even as she automatically crossed herself, with a brief prayer for the repose of Malva's soul. Who had it been? If ever there were a ghost that should walk. A small shiver passed over her, but that in turn gave her a new idea. "I think it was Mr. Buchanan Angelina saw," she said firmly. "But if you ever should be afraid of ghosts, or anything else, you just make the sign of the cross and say a quick prayer to your guardian angel." The words gave her a slight sense of dizziness. Perhaps it was déjà vu. She thought that someone, her mother, her father, had said exactly that to her sometime in the distant past of her childhood. What she had been afraid of, she no longer remembered that, but did remember the sense of security that the prayer had given her. Jem frowned uncertainly at that. He knew the sign of the cross, but wasn't so sure about the angel prayer. She rehearsed it with him, feeling slightly guilty as she did so. It was only a matter of time before he did something overtly Catholic, like make the sign of the cross, in front of someone who mattered to Roger. For the most part, people either assumed that the minister's wife was Protestant as well, or knew the truth, but were in no position to make a fuss about it. She was aware of a certain amount of muttering amongst Roger's flock, particularly in the wake of Mulver's death, and the talk about her parents. She felt her lips pressed tight again and consciously relaxed them, but Roger steadfastly refused to hear any such remarks. She felt a deep pang of longing for Roger, even with the worrying thought of potential religious complications fresh in her mind. He'd written. The Reverend Dr. McCorkle had been delayed, but should be in Edenton within the week. A week more, maybe, before the presbytery session convened, and then he'd be coming to River Run for her and Jem. He was so happy at the thought of his ordination. Surely, once he was ordained, they couldn't defrock him, if that's what happened to miscreant ministers, for having a Catholic wife, could they? Would she convert, if she had to, for Roger to be what he so clearly wanted and needed to be? The thought made her feel hollow, and she put her arms round Jemmy for reassurance. His skin was damp and still baby-soft, but she could feel the hardness of his bones pressing through, giving promise of a size that would likely one day match his father and grandfather. His father. There was a small, glowing thought that calmed all her anxieties and even soothed the ache of missing Roger. Jemmy's hair had long since grown again, but she kissed the spot behind his left ear where the hidden mark was, making him hunch his shoulders and giggle at the tickle of her breath on his neck. She sent him off, then, to take the paint-stained shirt to Matilda, the laundress, to see what might be done, and went back to her grinding. The mineral smell of the malachite in her mortar seemed vaguely wrong. She lifted it and sniffed, even as she did so, aware that that was ridiculous. Ground stone couldn't go bad. Maybe the mixture of turpentine and the fumes from Mr. Buchanan's pipe was affecting her sense of smell. She shook her head and scraped the soft green powder carefully out into a vial to be mixed with walnut oil or used in an egg tempera later. She cast an appraising eye over the selection of boxes and pouches, some supplied by Aunt Jocasta, others courtesy of John Gray, sent specially from London, and the vials and drying trays of the pigments she'd ground herself, to see what else might be needed. This afternoon she'd only be making preliminary sketches. The commission was for a portrait of Mr. Forbes' ancient mother, but she might have only a week or two to finish the job before Roger's return. She couldn't waste... A wave of dizziness made her sit down suddenly, and black spots flickered through her vision. She put her head between her knees, breathing deep. That didn't help. The air was raw with turps and thick with the meaty, decaying animal smells of the stables below. She lifted her head and grabbed for the edge of the table. Her inside seemed to have turned abruptly to a liquid substance that shifted with her movement like water in a bowl, sloshing from belly to throat and back, leaving the bitter yellow smell of bile at the back of her nose.
Oh, God!
The liquid in her belly rushed up her throat, and she had barely time to seize the washbasin from the table and dump the water on the floor before her stomach turned inside out in the frantic effort to empty itself. She set the basin down very carefully and sat panting, staring at the wet blotch on the floor as the world beneath her shifted on its axis and settled at a new, uneasy angle.
"Congratulations, Roger," she said out loud,
her voice sounding faint and uncertain in the close, damp air.
"I think you're going to be a daddy. Again."
She sat still for some time, cautiously exploring the sensations of her body, looking for certainty. She hadn't been sick with Jemmy, but she remembered the oddly altered quality of her senses, that odd state called synesthesia, where sight, smell, taste, and even sometimes hearing occasionally and weirdly took on characteristics of each other. It had gone away as abruptly as it had happened. The tang of Mr. Buchanan's tobacco was much stronger, but now it was only the mellow burning of cured leaves, not a mottled green-brown thing that writhed through her sinuses and rattled the membranes of her brain like a tin roof in a hailstorm. She had been concentrating so hard on her bodily sensations and what they might or might not mean that she hadn't really noticed the voices in the next room. That was Duncan's modest lair, where he kept the ledgers and accounts of the estate, and, she thought, went to hide when the grandeur of the house became too much for him. Mr. Buchanan was in there with Duncan now, and what had started out as a genial thrum of conversation was now showing signs of strain. She got up, relieved to feel only a slight residual clamminess now, and picked up the basin. She had the natural human inclinations toward eavesdropping, but lately she had been careful not to hear anything but what she must. Duncan and her Aunt Jocasta were stout loyalists, and nothing she could say by way of tactful urging or logical argument would sway them. She had overheard more than one of Duncan's private conversations with local Tories that made her heart go small with apprehension, knowing as she did what would be the outcome of the present events. Here in the Piedmont, in the heart of the Cape Fear country, most of the solid citizens were loyalists, convinced that the violence taking place to the north was an overblown rumpus that might be unnecessary, and if it was not, had little to do with them, and that what was most needed here was a firm hand to rein in the wild-eyed Whigs before their excesses provoked a ruinous retaliation. Knowing that exactly such a ruinous retaliation was coming, and to people she liked or even loved, gave her what her father called the grue, a cold sense of oppressive horror coiling through the blood. "When then?" Buchanan's voice came clearly as she opened the door, sounding impatient. "They will not wait, Duncan. I must have the money by Wednesday week, or Dunkling will sell the arms elsewhere. Ye ken as a seller's market the new. For gold he'll wait, but not for long." "Aye, I ken that fine Sony." Duncan sounded impatient and very uneasy, Brianna thought. "If it can be done, it will be." "If!" Buchanan cried. "What's this if? Till now it's been, oh, aye, Sony. Nay difficulty to be sure, Sony. Tell Dunklin it's on. Oh, of course, Sony." "I said, Alexandra, that if it can be done, it will." Duncan's voice was low, but suddenly had a note of steel in it that she had never heard before. Buchanan said something rude in the Gaelic, and suddenly the door of Duncan's office burst open, and the man himself popped out in so great a huff that he barely saw her and gave her no more than a brusque nod in passing. Which was just as well, she thought, since she was standing there holding a bowl full of vomit. Before she could move to dispose of it, Duncan came out in turn. He looked hot, cross, and extremely worried. He did, however, notice her. "How do you fare, lass?" he asked, squinting at her.
You're that bit green. Have you eaten Artemis?
I think so. But I'm all right now, she said, hastily turning to put the basin back in the room behind her. She set it on the floor and closed the door on it. Are you, all right, Duncan? He hesitated for an instant, but whatever was bothering him was too overwhelming to keep it bottled up. He glanced about, but none of the slaves was up here at this time of day. He leaned close, nonetheless, and lowered his voice.
Have you by any chance seen anything peculiar, Anian?
Peculiar? How?
He rubbed a knuckle under his drooping moustache and glanced round once more.
Near Hector Cameron's tomb, say? He asked, his voice pitched only just above a whisper.
Her diaphragm, still sore from vomiting, contracted sharply at that, and she put a hand to her middle.
You have, then?
Duncan's expression sharpened.
Not me, she said, and explained about Jemmy, Angelina, and the supposed ghost.
I thought perhaps it was Mr. Buchanan, she finished, nodding toward the stair down which Alexander Buchanan had vanished.
Now there's a thought, Duncan muttered, rubbing distractedly at his grizzled temple. But no, surely not. He couldn't. But it's a thought.
Brianna thought that he looked very slightly more hopeful. Duncan, can you tell me what's wrong? He took a deep breath, shaking his head, not in refusal, but in perplexity, and let it out again, his shoulders slumping.
The gold, he said simply. It's gone.
£7,000 in gold bullion was a substantial amount in all senses of the word. She had no idea how much such a sum might weigh, but it had completely lined Jocasta's coffin, standing chastely next to Hector Cameron's in the family mausoleum.
What do you mean, gone? She blurted. All of it?
Duncan clutched her arm, features contorted in the urge to shush her.
Aye, all of it, he said, looking round yet again. For God's sake, lass, keep your voice down.
When did it go?
Or rather, she amended, when did you find it gone? Last night.
He looked round yet again and jerked his chin toward his office.
Come in, lass. I'll tell you about it.
Duncan's agitation subsided a little as he told her the story. By the time he had finished, he had regained a certain amount of outward calm. The £7,000 was what was left of the original £10,000, which in turn was one-third of the £30,000 sent, too late, but sent nonetheless, from Louis of France in support of Charles Stuart's doomed attempt on the thrones of England and Scotland.
Hector was careful, eh? Duncan explained. He lived as a rich man, but always within such means as a place like this.
He waved his one hand around, indicating the grounds and messuages of River Run.
Might provide. He spent £1,000 acquiring the land and building the house. Then over the years another £1,000 in slaves, cattle and the like. And £1,000 he put to the bankers. Joe said he couldn't bear the thought of all that money sitting, earning nae interest.
He gave her a small, wry smile,
though he was too clever to attract attention by putting it all out. I suppose he meant, maybe, to invest the rest, a bit at a time. But he died before that was done.
Leaving Jocasta as a very wealthy widow, but even more cautious than her husband had been about attracting undue attention. And so the gold had sat, safe in its hiding place, save for the one ingot being gradually whittled away and disposed of by Ulysses. Which had disappeared, she remembered with a qualm.
Someone knew there was gold here.
Perhaps whoever had taken that ingot had guessed that there was more, and hunted quietly, patiently, until they found it.
But now? He'll have heard about General MacDonald.
She'd heard the name frequently of late, in conversation. He was a Scottish general, more or less retired, she'd assumed, who'd been staying here and there the guest of various prominent families. She hadn't heard of his purpose, though.
He means to raise men, 3,004, among the Highlanders to march to the coast. The governor's sent for aid. Troop ships are coming. So the general's men will come down through the Cape Fear Valley.
He made a graceful swooping gesture with his hand.
Meet the governor and his troops, and pincer the rebel militias that are a-building.
And you meant to give him the gold? Oh, no, she corrected herself. You meant to give him arms and powder. He nodded and chewed his moustaches, looking unhappy.
A man named Dunkling, Alexander knows him. Lord Dunsmore is gathering a great store of powder and arms in Virginia, and Dunkling is one of his lieutenants, and willing to give up some of that store in return for gold.
Which is now gone. She took a deep breath, feeling sweat trickle down between her breasts, further dampening her shift.
Which is now gone, he agreed bleakly. And I'm left to wonder, what about this ghost of wee gems, eh?
Ghost indeed. For someone to have entered a place like River Run, teeming with people, and to have moved several hundred pounds by weight of gold completely unnoticed. The sound of feet on the stairs caused Duncan to jerk his head sharply toward the door. But it was only Josh, one of the black grooms, his hat in his hand.
Best we be goin', Miss Bree, he said, bowing respectfully, if you be wanting the light like.
For her drawings, he meant. It was a good hour's trip into Cross Creek to Lawyer Forbes's house, and the sun was fast rising toward noon. She glanced at her green-smeared fingers and recalled the hair straggling untidily down from its makeshift bun. She'd have to tidy herself a bit first.
Go, lass.
Duncan waved her toward the door, his lean face still creased with worry, but lightened a little by having shared it. She kissed him affectionately on the forehead and went down after Josh. She was worried, and not only about missing gold and prowling ghosts.
General MacDonald, indeed,
for if he meant to raise fighting men among the Highlanders, one of the natural places for him to go was to her father.
As Roger had noted to her some time earlier, Jamie can walk the tightrope between Whigs and Tories better than any man I know. But when push comes to shove, he'll have to jump.
The push had come at Mecklenburg, but shove, she thought, was named MacDonald. Chapter 100. A Trip to the Seaside. Neil Forbes, thinking it prudent to be absent from his usual haunts for a time, had removed to Edenton, with the excuse of taking his aged mother to visit her even more aged sister. He had enjoyed the long journey, in spite of his mother's complaints about the clouds of dust raised by another carriage that preceded them. He had been loath to sacrifice his sight of that carriage, a small, well-sprung affair, whose windows were sealed and heavily curtained. But he'd always been a devoted son, and at the next post-stop he went to speak to the driver. The other coach obligingly dropped back, following them at a convenient distance.
"Whatever are you looking at, Neil?"
his mother demanded, looking up from fastening her favourite garnet brooch.
"That's the third time you've had a kick out of one window."
"Not a thing, ma'am," he said, inhaling deeply. "Only taking pleasure in the day. Such beautiful weather, is it not?"
Mrs. Forbes sniffed, but obligingly settled her spectacles on her nose and leaned to peer out.
"Aye, well, it's fair enough," she admitted dubiously. "Hot, though, and damp enough to wring buckets from your shirt."
"Never mind, Eliannon," he said, patting her black-clad shoulder. "We'll be in Edenton afore you know. It'll be cooler there. Nothing like a sea breeze, so they say, to put the roses in your cheeks."
Chapter 101. Night Watch. Edenton. The Reverend Macmillan's house was on the water, a blessing in the hot, muggy weather. The offshore breeze in the evening swept everything away, heat, half-smoke, mosquitoes. The men sat on the big porch after supper, smoking their pipes and enjoying the respite. Roger's enjoyment was spiced by the guilty awareness that Mrs. Reverend Macmillan and her three daughters were sweating to and fro, washing dishes, clearing away, sweeping floors, boiling up the leftover ham bones from supper with lentils for tomorrow's soup, putting children to bed, and generally slaving away in the stuffy, sweltering confines of the house. At home, he would have felt obliged to help with such work or face Brianna's wrath. Here, such an offer would have been received with drop-jawed incredulity, followed by deep suspicion. Instead, he sat peacefully in the cool evening breeze, watching fishing boats come in across the water of the Sound, and sipping something that passed for coffee, engaged in pleasant male conversation.
There was, he thought, occasionally something to be said for the 18th-century model of sexual roles.
They were talking over the news from the south, the flight of Governor Martin from New Bern, the burning of Fort Johnston. The political climate of Edenton was strongly Whiggish, and the company was largely clerical. The Reverend Dr. McCorkle, his secretary Warren Lee, the Reverend J. Macmillan, Reverend Patrick Dugan, and four inquirers awaiting ordination beside Roger. But there were still currents of political disagreement flowing beneath the outwardly cordial surface of the conversation. Roger himself said little. He didn't wish to offend Macmillan's hospitality by contributing to any argument. And something inside him wished for quiet, to contemplate tomorrow. Then the conversation took a new turn, though, and he found himself paying rapt attention. The Continental Congress had met in Philadelphia 2 months before, and given General Washington command of the Continental Army. Warren Lee had been in Philadelphia at the time, and was giving the company a vivid account of the battle at Breed's Hill, at which he had been present.
General Putnam, he brought up wagon loads of dirt and brush to the neck of the Charlestown Peninsula. You said you knew it, sir, he asked courteously, turning toward Roger. Well, Colonel Prescott, he's there already with two militia companies from Massachusetts, and parts of another from Connecticut. Was maybe 1,000 men in all, and dear Lord, was they a stench from the camps.
His soft southern accent, Lee was a Virginian, held a slight touch of amusement, but this faded as he went on.
General Ward, he'd given orders to fortify this one hill. Bunker Hill, they call it, for an old redoubt atop. But Colonel Prescott, he goes up it and don't care so much for the looks, him and Mr. Gridley, the engineer. So they leave a detachment there and go on to Breed's Hill, what they think is maybe better to the purpose, being closer to the harbour. Now, this is all at night, mind. I was with one of the Massachusetts companies, and we marched right smart, and then spent the whole night through, twixt midnight and dawn, digging trenches and raising up 6-foot walls about the perimeter. Come the dawn, and we skulked down behind our fortifications, and just in time, too, for there's a British ship in the harbour. The Lively, they said, and she opens fire the minute the sun's up. Looked right pretty, for the fog was still on the water, and the cannon lit it up in red flashes. Did no harm, though. Most all the balls fell short into the harbour. Did see one whaleboat at the docks hit, though. Stove it like kindling. The crew, they hopped out like fleas when the Lively took to firing. From where I was, I could just see 'em hopping up and down on the dock, a-shaking their fists. Then the Lively let off another broadside, and they all fell flat or run like rabbits.
The light was nearly gone, and Lee's young face invisible in the shadows. But the amusement in his voice made a small rumble of laughter run among the other men.
There was some firing from a little battery up on Copp's Hill, and one or two of the other ships, they let off a pop or two. But they could see 'twant no earthly use and ceased. Then come in some fellows from New Hampshire to join up with us, and that was purely heartening. But General Putnam, he sends a good many men back to work on the fortifications at Bunker. And the New Hampshire folk, they're crouched way down on the left, where they's got no cover beyond rail fences stuffed with mown grass. Looking at 'em down there, I was as pleased as Punch to have 4 feet of solid earthwork in front of me, I tell you, gentlemen.
The British troops had set out across the Charles River, bold as brass under the midday sun, with the warships behind them, and the batteries on shore all providing covering fire.
We didn't fire back, of course, had no cannon, Lee said with an audible shrug.
Roger, listening intently, couldn't keep from asking a question at this point.
Is it true that Colonel Stark said, "Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes"?
Lee coughed discreetly.
Well, sir, I couldn't say for sure as no one said that, but I didn't hear it myself. Mind, I did hear one colonel call out, "Any horse and fool wastes his powder afore the bastards are close enough to kill is going to get his musket shoved up his ass, but first."
The assembly erupted into laughter. An inquiry from Mrs. McMillan, who had come out to offer further refreshment as to the source of this merriment, shut them all up sharp, though, and they listened with a fair assumption of sober attention to the rest of Lee's account.
"Well, so then on they come, and I will say 'twas a daunting sight. They'd several regiments, and all in their different colours, fusiliers and grenadiers, Royal Marines, and a proper boiling of light infantry, all coming on over the ground like a horde of ants and just as mean. I wouldn't make great claim to bravery myself, gentlemen, but I would say the fellows standing with me had some nerve. We did let them come, and the first ranks weren't no more than 10 feet away when our volleys cut into them. They rallied, came back on, and we cut them down again like ninepins. And the officers, there was a powerful lot of the officers went. They were on their horses, see? I shot one such. He keeled over, but he didn't fall off. His horse carried him away, kind of lolling with his head loose. But he didn't fall."
Lee's voice had lost some of its colour, and Roger saw the burly form of the Reverend Dr. McCorkle lean toward his secretary, touching his shoulder.
"They rallied a third time and came on, and we were most of us out of ammunition. They came on over the earthworks and through the fences, with their bayonets fixed."
Roger was sitting on the steps of the porch, Lee above him, and several feet away, but could hear the young man swallow.
"We fell back. That's how they say it. We ran is what we did. So they..."
He swallowed again.
"A bayonet. It makes a terrible sound going into a man. Just terrible. I can't say how it is, describe it properly. Heard it, though, and more than once. Was a good many run straight through the body that day, skewered, and then the steel pulled out, and they left to die on the ground, flopping like fish."
Roger had seen, handled, 18th-century bayonets often. A 17-inch triangular blade, heavy and brutal, with a blood groove down one side. He thought, quite suddenly, of the furrowed scar that ran up Jamie Fraser's thigh, and rose to his feet. Murmuring a brief excuse, he left the porch and walked down to the shore, pausing only for a moment to shed his shoes and stockings. The tide was going out. Sand and shingle were wet and cool under his bare feet. The breeze rattled faintly among palmetto palms behind him, and a line of pelicans flew down the shore, solemn against the last of the light. He walked a little way into the surf, small rippling waves that tugged at his heels, sucking the sand away beneath him, making him shift and sway to keep his balance. Far out on the water of Albemarle Sound, he could see lights, fishing boats with small fires built in sandboxes aboard to light the torches the fishermen swung over the side. These seemed to float in the air, swinging to and fro, the reflections in the water winking slowly in and out like fireflies. The stars were coming out. He stood looking up, trying to empty his mind, his heart, open himself to the love of God. Tomorrow he would be a minister. "Thou art a priest forever," said the ordination service, quoting from the Bible, "after the order of Melchizedek." "Are you afraid?" Brianna had asked him when he'd told her.
"Yeah," he said softly, aloud.
He stood until the tide left him, then followed it, walking into the water, wanting the rhythmic touch of the waves.
"Will you do it anyway?"
"Yeah," he said, more softly still. He had no idea what he was agreeing to, but said it anyway. Far down the beach, behind him, the breeze brought him now and then a snatch of laughter, a few words from the Reverend McMillan's porch. They had moved on then, from the talk of war and death.
Had any of them ever killed a man? Lee, perhaps. The Reverend Dr. McCorkle. He snorted a little at the thought, but didn't dismiss it. He turned and walked a little further until the only sounds were those of the waves and the offshore wind.
Soul-searching. It was what squires used to do, he thought, smiling a little wryly at the thought.
The night before he became a knight, a young man would keep vigil in church or chapel, watching through the dark hours, lighted only by the glow of a sanctuary lamp, praying.
For what? He wondered. Purity of mind? Singleness of purpose? Courage?
Or perhaps forgiveness?
He hadn't meant to kill Randall Lillington. That had been almost accident, and what wasn't had been self-defence. But he had been hunting when he did it, had gone out looking for Stephen Bonnet, meaning to kill him in cold blood. And Harley Bobble. He could still see the shine of the thief-taker's eyes, feel the echo of the blow, the shards of the man's skull reverberating through the bones of his own arm. He'd meant that, yes. Could have stopped? Didn't.
Tomorrow he would swear before God that he believed in the doctrine of predestination, that he had been meant to do what he had done.
Perhaps. Maybe I don't believe that so much, he thought, doubt stealing in. But maybe I do. Christ! Oh, sorry, he apologised mentally. Can I be a proper minister with doubts?
I think everyone's got them. But if I've got too many, maybe you'd best let me know now, before it's too late.
His feet had gone numb, and the sky was ablaze with a glory of stars thick in the black velvet night. He heard the crunch of footsteps among the shingle and the sea-rack nearby. It was Warren Lee, tall and gangly by starlight, the Reverend Doctor's secretary, erstwhile militiaman.
"Thought I'd take a bit of air," Lee said, his voice hardly audible above the hiss of the sea.
"Aye, well, there's a lot of it, and it's free," Roger said, as amiably as he could. Lee chuckled briefly in response, but luckily didn't seem disposed to talk. They stood for some time, watching the fishing boats, then, by unspoken consent, turned to go back. The house was dark, the porch deserted. A single candle burned in the window, though, lighting them home.
"That officer, the one I shot," Lee blurted suddenly. "I pray for him every night."
Lee shut up abruptly, embarrassed.
Roger breathed slow and deep, feeling the jerk of his own heart. Had he ever prayed for Lillington or Bobble?
"I will, too," he said.
"Thank you," said Lee, very softly, and side by side they made their way back up the beach, pausing to pick up their shoes, going back barefooted, sand drying on their feet. They had sat down on the steps to brush it off before going in, when the door behind them opened.
"Mr. Mackenzie," said the Reverend Macmillan,
and something in his voice pulled Roger to his feet, heart pounding.
"You have a visitor?"
He saw the tall silhouette behind Macmillan, and knew, even before Jamie Fraser's pale, fierce face appeared, eyes black in the candlelight.
"He's taken Brianna," Jamie said without preamble. "You'll come."
Chapter 102. Anemone. Feet trampled back and forth overhead, and she could hear voices, but most of the words were too muffled to make out. There was a chorus of jovial shouts on the side nearest shore, and cordial feminine shrieks in reply. The cabin had a wide-paned window. Did you call it a window on a ship, she wondered, or had it some special nautical name that ran behind the bunk, raked back with the angle of the stern? It was made in small, thick panes set in leading. No hope there of escape, but it did offer the possibility of air, and perhaps information regarding their whereabouts. Repressing a qualm of nauseated distaste, she clambered across the stained and rumpled sheets of the bed. She pressed close to the window and pushed her face into one of the open panes, taking deep breaths to dispel the aromas of the cabin, though the smell of the harbour was no great improvement, rife as it was with the smell of dead fish
sewage and baking mud. She could see a small dock and moving figures on it. A fire was burning on the shore, outside a low, whitewashed building roofed with palmetto leaves. It was too dark to see what, if anything, lay beyond the building. There must be at least a small town, though, judging from the noise of the people on the dock. There were voices outside the cabin door, coming closer. "Meet him on Ocracoke, the dark of the moon," said one, to which the other replied in an indistinct mumble before the door flew open. "Care to join the party, sweetheart? Or have you started without me?" She whirled on her knees, heart hammering in her throat. Stephen Bonnet stood inside the door to the cabin, a bottle in one hand, and a slight smile on his face. She took a deep breath to quell the shock and nearly gagged on the stale scent of sex that wafted from the sheets under her knees. She scrambled off the bed, heedless of her clothes, and felt a rip at the waist as her knee caught in her skirt. "Where are we?" she demanded. Her voice sounded shrill, panicked to her own ears.
"On the anemone," he said patiently, still smiling.
"You know that isn't what I mean." The neck of her gown and chemise had torn in the struggle when the men pulled her from her horse, and most of one breast was exposed. She put up a hand, pushing the fabric back in place.
"Do I?"
He set the bottle on the desk and reached to unfasten the stock from his neck.
"Ah, that's better."
He rubbed at the dark red line across his throat, and she had a sudden, piercing vision of Roger's throat with its ragged scar.
"I wish to know what this town is called," she said, deepening her voice and fixing him with a gimlet eye.
She didn't expect that what worked on her father's tenants would work on him, but the assumption of an air of command helped to steady her a bit.
"Well, that's an easily gratified wish, to be sure."
He waved a casual hand toward the shore.
"Roanoke."
He shucked his coat, tossing it carelessly over the stool. The linen of his shirt was crumpled and clung damply to his chest and shoulders.
"You'd best take off the gown, darling. It's hot."
He reached for the strings that tied his shirt, and she moved abruptly away from the bed, glancing round the cabin, searching the shadows for something that could be used as a weapon. Stool, lamp, logbook, bottle. There. A piece of wood showed among the rubble on the desk, the blunt end of a marlin spike. He frowned, attention fastened momentarily on a knot in the string. She took two long steps and seized the marlin spike, yanking it off the desk in a shower of rubbish and clanging oddments. "Stand back!" She held the thing like a baseball bat, gripped in both hands. Sweat streamed down the hollow of her back, but her hands felt cold and her face went hot and cold and hot again, ripples of heat and terror rolling down her skin. Bonnet looked at her as though she'd gone mad.
"Whatever will you be after doing with that woman?"
He left off fiddling with his shirt and took a step toward her. She took one back, raising the club.
"Don't fucking touch me!"
He stared at her, eyes fixed wide, pale green and unblinking above a small, odd smile. Still smiling, he took another step toward her, then another, and the fear boiled off in a surge of rage. Her shoulders bunched and lifted, ready.
"I mean it. Stand back or I'll kill you. I'll know who this baby's father is if I die for it."
He had raised a hand as though to grasp the club and jerk it away from her, but at this he stopped abruptly.
"Baby, you're with child."
She swallowed, her breath still thick in her throat. The blood hammered in her ears and the smooth wood was slick with sweat from her palms. She tightened her grip, trying to keep the rage alive, but it was already dying.
"Yes, I think so. I'll know for sure in 2 weeks."
His sandy eyebrows lifted. With a short grunt, he stepped back, surveying her with interest. Slowly, his eyes travelled over her, appraising her one bared breast. The sudden spurt of rage had drained away, leaving her breathless and empty-bellied. She kept hold of the marlin spike, but her wrists quivered, and she lowered it.
"Is that the way of it, then?"
He leaned forward and reached out, quite without lascivious intent now. Startled, she froze for an instant, and he weighed the breast in one hand,
kneading thoughtfully, as though it were a grapefruit he meant to buy at market. She gasped and hit at him one-handed with the club, but she had lost what readiness she had, and the blow bounced off his shoulder, rocking him but having little other effect. He grunted and stepped back, rubbing at his shoulder.
Could be. Well, then. He frowned and tugged at the front of his breeches, adjusting himself without the slightest embarrassment. Lucky we're in port, I suppose.
She made no sense whatever of this remark, but didn't care. Apparently he had changed his mind upon hearing her revelation, and the feeling of relief made her knees go weak and her skin prickle with sweat. She sat down quite suddenly upon the stool, the club clanking to the floor beside her.
Bonnet had put his head out into the corridor and was bellowing for someone named Auden. Whoever Auden was, he didn't come into the cabin, but within a few moments a voice mumbled interrogatively outside. "Fetch me down a whore from the docks," Bonnet said in the casual tone of one ordering a fresh pint of bitter. "Clean, mind, and fairly young."
He shut the door then, and turned to the table, scrabbling through the debris until he unearthed a pewter cup. He poured a drink, quaffed half of it, and then, seeming belatedly to realise that she was still there, offered her the bottle with a vague of invitation. She shook her head, wordless. A faint hope had sprung up in the back of her mind. He did have some faint streak of gallantry, or at least decency. He had come back to rescue her from the burning warehouse, and he had left the stone for what he assumed to be his child. Now he had abandoned his advances upon hearing that she was with child again. Perhaps he would let her go then, particularly if she was of no immediate use to him.
"So you don't want me?" she said, edging her feet under her, ready to leap up and run as soon as the door opened to admit her replacement. She hoped she could run. Her knees were still trembling with reaction. Bonnet glanced at her, surprised. "I've split your quim once already, sweetheart," he said, and grinned. "I recall the red hair, a lovely sight, sure, but it wasn't so memorable an experience, otherwise that I can't be waiting to repeat it. Time enough, darling, time enough."
He chucked her negligently under the chin and gulped more of his drink.
"For now, though, Leroy's needing a bit of a gallop."
"Why am I here?" she demanded. Distracted, he pulled once more at the crotch of his breeches, quite unself-conscious for her presence.
"Here? Why, because a gentleman paid me to take you to London town, darling. Didn't you know?"
She felt as though someone had hit her in the stomach, and sat down on the bed, folding her arms protectively across her midsection.
"What gentleman? And for God's sake, why?"
He considered for a moment, but evidently concluded that there was no reason not to tell her.
"A man named Forbes," he said,
and threw back the rest of his drink.
"Know him, do you?"
"I most certainly do," she said, amazement vying with fury. "That bloody bastard."
So they were Forbes's men, the masked bandits that had stopped her and Josh, dragged them from their horses, and shoved them both into a sealed carriage, bumping over unseen roads for days on end until they reached the coast, and then been pulled out, dishevelled and reeking, and bundled aboard the ship.
"Where's Joshua?" she asked abruptly.
"The young black man who was with me."
"Was there?"
Bonnet looked quizzical.
"If they brought him aboard, I imagine they've put him in the hold with the other cargo. A bonus, I suppose," he added, and laughed.
Her fury at Forbes had been tinged with relief at finding out he was the motive behind her abduction. Forbes might be a low-down, sneaking scoundrel, but he wouldn't be intending to murder her. That laugh of Stephen Bonnet's, though, made a cold qualm run through her, and she felt suddenly light-headed.
"What do you mean, a bonus?"
Bonnet scratched his cheek, gooseberry eyes roaming over her in approval.
"Oh, well then, Mr. Forbes only wanted you out of the way," he said. "Whatever did you do to the man, darling? But he's paid your fare already, and I've the impression that he's no great interest in where you end up."
"Where I end up?"
Her mouth had been dry. Now saliva was pouring from her membranes, and she had to swallow repeatedly.
"Well, after all, darling, why bother taking you all the way to London, where you'd be of no particular use to anyone? Besides, it rains quite a bit in London. I'm sure you wouldn't like it."
Before she could draw breath to ask any more questions, the door opened, and a young woman slid through, closing it behind her. She was likely in her 20s, though with a missing molar that showed when she smiled. She was plump and plain-faced, brown-haired, and clean by local standards, though the scent of her sweat and waves of freshly applied cheap cologne wafted across the cabin, making Brianna want to throw up again.
"Hello, Stephen," the newcomer said, standing on tiptoe to kiss Bonnet's cheek. "Give us a drink to be starting with, eh?"
Bonnet grabbed her, gave her a deep and lingering kiss, then let her go and reached for the bottle. Coming down onto her heels, she looked at Brianna with detached professional interest, then back at Bonnet, and scratched at her neck.
"You'll have the two of us, Stephen, or shall it be me and her to start? It's a quid more, either way."
Bonnet didn't bother answering, but thrust the bottle into her hand, whipped off the kerchief that hid the swell of her heavy breasts, and began at once to undo his flies. He dropped the breeches on the floor, and without ado, seized the woman by the hips and pressed her against the door. Guzzling from the bottle she held in one hand, the young woman snatched up her skirts with the other, whisking skirt and petticoat out of the way with a practiced motion that bared her to the waist. Brianna caught a glimpse of sturdy thighs and a patch of dark hair before they were obscured by Bonnet's buttocks, blonde-furred and clenched with effort. She turned her head away, cheeks burning, but morbid fascination compelled her to glance back. The whore was standing balanced on her toes, squatting slightly to accommodate him, gazing placidly over his shoulder as he thrust and grunted. One hand still held the bottle, the other stroked Bonnet's shoulders in a practiced way. She caught Brianna's eye on her and winked, still saying,
"Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That's good, love. So good,"
in her client's ear. The cabin door quivered with each meaty thump of the whore's backside, and Brianna could hear laughter in the corridor outside, both male and female. Evidently, Auden had brought back enough to supply crew as well as captain. Bonnet heaved and grunted for a minute or two, then gave a loud groan, his movement suddenly jerky and uncoordinated. The whore put a helpful hand on his buttocks and pulled him close, then relaxed her grip as his body went limp, leaning heavily against her. She supported him for a moment, patting his back matter-of-factly like a mother burping a baby, then pushed him off. His face and neck were flushed dark red, and he was breathing heavily. He nodded to the whore and stooped, fumbling for his breeches. He stood up with them and waved toward the littered desk.
"Help yourself to your pay, darling, but give me back the bottle, aye?"
The whore pouted slightly, but took a final deep gulp of the liquor and handed him the bottle, now no more than a quarter full. She pulled a wadded cloth from the pocket at her waist and clapped it between her thighs, then shook down her skirts and minced across to the desk, poking delicately among the litter of her scattered coins, which she picked out with two fingers, dropping them one by one into the depths of her pocket. Bonnet, clothed once more, went out without a backward glance at the two women. The air in the cabin was hot and thick with the scent of sex, and Brianna felt her stomach clench, not with revulsion, but with panic. The strong male reek had triggered an instinctive flush of response that tingled across her breasts and gripped her inwardly. For a brief, disorienting moment, she felt Roger's skin slick with sweat against her own, and her breasts tingled, swollen and wanting. She pressed both lips and legs tight together and curled her hands into fists, breathing shallowly. The last thing she could stand right now, she thought, the very last thing, was to think of Roger and sex while anywhere within miles of Stephen Bonnet. She resolutely pushed the thought aside and edged closer to the whore, searching for some remark with which to open conversation. The whore sensed the movement and glanced at Brianna, taking in both the torn dress and its quality, but then dismissed her in favour of finding more coins. Once she had her pay, the woman would leave, going back to the docks. It was a chance to get word to Roger and her parents. Not much, perhaps, but a chance.
"You, know him well?"
she said. The whore glanced at her, eyebrows lifted.
Who? Oh, Stephen.
Aye, he's a good un, Stephen.
She shrugged.
Don't take more than 2 or 3 minutes. No bones about the money. Never wants nothing but a simple swive. He's rough now and then, but he don't hit unless you cross him. And no one's fool enough to do that.
No more than once, any road. Her gaze lingered for a moment on Brianna's torn dress, one brow lifted sardonically. I'll remember that, Brianna said dryly, and pulled the edge of her ripped chemise up higher. She glimpsed a glass bottle amid the rubble on the desk, filled with a clear liquid containing a small, round object. She leaned closer to look at it, frowning.
It couldn't be.
But it was. A round, fleshy object, rather like a hard-boiled egg, a pinkish-grey in colour, with a neat round hole drilled completely through it. She crossed herself, feeling faint.
I was that surprised, the whore went on, eyeing Brianna with open curiosity. He's never had two girls together, so far as I know, and he's not one as wants someone to watch while he's at his pleasure.
I'm not... Brianna began, but then stopped, not wanting to offend the woman.
Not a whore.
The young woman grinned broadly, exposing the black gap of her missing tooth.
Am I, I guess, as much chicky? Not as it would make no never mind to Stephen. He sews as he likes, and I can see as how he might like you.
Most men would. She looked at Brianna with dispassionate assessment, nodding at her dishevelled hair, flushed face, and tidy figure.
I expect they like you too, Brianna said politely, with a faint feeling of surreality.
What's your name?
Hepzibah, the woman said, with an air of pride, or Epi, for short, like. There were coins still on the desk, but the whore left them alone. Bonnet might be generous, but evidently the whore didn't want to take advantage of him. More likely a sign of fear than of friendship, Brianna thought. She took a deep breath and pressed on.
What a lovely name. Pleased to meet you, Epi.
She held out a hand.
My name is Brianna Fraser McKenzie.
She gave all three names, hoping that the whore would remember at least one of them. The woman glanced at the extended hand in puzzlement, then gingerly shook it, dropping it like a dead fish. She pulled up her skirt and began to clean herself with the rag, fastidiously wiping away all traces of the recent encounter. Brianna leaned closer, bracing herself against the odours of the stained rag, the woman's body, and the hot smell of liquor on her breath.
"Stephen Bonnet kidnapped me," she said.
"Oh, aye," said the whore, indifferent. "Well, he takes as he likes, the Stephen."
"I want to get away," Brianna said, keeping her voice low with a glance at the cabin door.
She could hear the sound of feet on the deck overhead and hoped voices wouldn't carry through the heavy planks. Epi wadded up the rag and dropped it on the desk. She rummaged in her pocket, coming up with a small bottle stoppered with a plug of wax. She still held her skirts up, and Brianna could see the silvery streaks of stretch marks across her plump belly.
"Well, give him what he wants, then," the whore advised,
taking out the plug and pouring a bit of the bottle's contents, a surprisingly mild scent of rosewater, into her hand.
"Chances are he'll tire of you in a few days and put you ashore."
She wiped the rosewater lavishly over her pubic hair, then sniffed critically at her hand and made a face.
"No. I mean, that's not what he kidnapped me for, I don't think," she added.
Epi recorked the bottle and dropped both it and the rag into her pocket.
"Oh, he means to ransom you?"
Epi eyed her with a little more interest.
"Still, I've never known scruples interfere with a man's appetite. He'd take a virgin's maidenhead and sell her back to her father before her belly started swelling."
She pursed her lips, a belated thought coming to her.
"So, how did you talk him out of having you, then?"
Brianna put a hand on her stomach.
"I told him I was pregnant. That stopped him. I wouldn't have thought a man like that, but it did. Perhaps he's better than you think?" she asked with a wisp of hope.
Eppie laughed at that, small eyes squeezing half-shut with hilarity at the thought.
"Stephen? God, no."
She sniffed with amusement and smoothed down her skirts.
"No," she went on more matter-of-factly. "Best story you could tell, though, if you don't want him at you. He called me down to him once, then put me off when he saw I'd a cake in the oven. When I joked about it, he said he'd once taken a whore with her belly the size of a cannonball. And right in the midst of it, she gave a groan, and the blood came spurting out of her, fit to drench the room. Put him right off, he said, and no wonder. Left our Stephen with a horror of swiving girls what are up the spout. He's taking no chances, see?"
"I see." A trickle of sweat ran down Brianna's cheek, and she wiped it away with the back of her hand. Her mouth felt dry, and she sucked the inside of her cheek for moisture. "The woman? What happened to her?"
Hepzibah looked blank for a moment. "Oh, the whore? Why, she died, of course, poor cow.